Okay, this is continuing with Jean-Louis Steinberg on 8th July 76 at Meudon.
Okay, now, so we are talking about this.
You're talking about the scintillation phenomenon.
Yes. And so what we found is that when the sun sets, we could not observe sun rising. Yes. And so that when the sun sets, you find that first, each radiation goes down when the elevation goes down. And second, that on that general fall of the intensity, you get withdrawals. You get huge variations, 3-4 dB easily.
Which get larger.
Lower and lower of the average fall.
Which get larger as you get closer to the horizon.
They get larger, and then you get closer to the horizon. So we said, first we thought that this is partial reflection on these roofs. And we could not easily eliminate that possibility. So we said, okay, we are going to move that equipment to Nancy. And in Nancy, we shall be on the top of trees, and we knew from papers published about radar that it was very likely to be absorbing trees. And so we found the same phenomenon. And so we said, okay, there is a phenomenon we should study. And so then we realized, and I think that Denis was instrumental in realizing that we should have a second antenna. We should do space correlation. And so then we decided to have the second mirror equipped. So we built a second radiometer and everything. And that second radiometer was mounted on a tower, which was mounted on a chassis, running on that 6 meters gauge track, which was used for the second time. And then we found space correlations, we changed the baseline, all this, and that ended up into scintillation work by Cazes and ended up to PhD.
Now these scintillations are in the tropopause?
Yeah,
that was the explanation.
We think we proved that they were in the tropopause by studying the correlation with tropospheric winds. Stratospheric winds. So we got balloon soundings results from the meteorological offices and other people. And some of them were done on purpose for us. And also we discovered that the pattern of these oscillations changed with the solar activity. And so that has been interpreted by me and later on by Arsac in a much better and formal way in a paper which he published in Astrophysics. Where he interpreted it in terms of a diffraction pattern on the ground and moving, so he introduced there the three parameters about the diffracting screen, the size of the source, and all the distances which are
right.
The wavelength.
Right.
And this was a very good paper, by the way. It has been redone all over and over again by lots of other people who never read their standard astrophysics paper.
When was that paper?
I don't know. The late 1950s. But we could press it.
Yeah, sure, I could find it.
We could find it in
I could find it right here. Probably.
You can find it easily. But maybe I'm wrong by 5 years, I can't think.
Okay, let me just ask about a couple other odd papers. Bloom, Denis, and Steinberg in 54, you went back to your 1949-1950 observations, and you talked about 29 megahertz galactic radiation being attenuated by ionospheric layers.
Well, this is something we started in Marcucci also. Bloom designed a very stable receivers for that kind of frequency, and we got two or three dipoles erected on top of the ground, I mean, on poles, and an artificial spring mounted on the top. And the idea was to study systematically the absorption of cosmic noise, you know, by the ionosphere. It gives you a hand on the ionospheric structure, total electron content. There were no spacecraft at the time.
Right.
So it was carried out for some months, I mean, some years.
In 1949.
On a routine basis, for several years, I think. And maybe we published in some...
But you didn't publish until 54, I was just curious.
Well, just because probably it took us several years because we got enough results so that there were enough cases. I think that you can do this only on a statistical basis. But this is now used on a routine basis all the world over.
Right. Well, this is the rheometer, basically.
Yes, the rheometer.
Right. Okay. In 55, Denis, LaRue, and Steinberg, you published a paper on several radio sources being found at 33 centimeters.
Yeah, well,
this
was
galactic
done.
Plane.
Yeah, this was done on the observation. So LaRue was in the. LaRue came with us in the late 40s, I guess, 48, 49, because he came with us in 51. And at that time, he had designed a DC to AC converter, because we thought that we would not get a frequency stable mains in Africa, and so we decided to frequency change it. And
no,
so we started from 50 ACs, 50 cycles ACs, rectify it, and then remodulate it. And so we did this with what we call at that time thyroid ones, mercury control tubes, mercury vapor. Oops. And Lahu designed all of it. But I discovered Lahu when teaching at the Sorbonne. I taught at that time, I taught in France, part-time, you know, a few hours a week. And I was supposed to teach applications, I mean, you know, not really the full course itself, but applications. And that was very useful because the teacher, I mean, the professor at that time, he was filling the blackboard with three times integrals, you know, four times, right. And they could not follow it.
Yeah.
And so I used to teach the telegraphic equations, you know, and standing waves and SWR measurements and things like this, much more practical. Except right. That we had no money to build any equipment to teach those people.
Yeah.
And Laurent came to me and he told me, well, look, all of this is very nice, I understand most of it, but I would like to see waveguides. And so we were developing in the lab waveguide equipment, and so I told him, well, come, we shall show you what we're doing. And so he became very excited. And so I told him, well, look, why don't you come with us and work with us? He said, yes, why not? So I said, okay, so I'm going to file an application for you to get a grant or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we filed the application, and Laurent was a Briton. His family is from the center of Brittany. He was living in Paris, and later on I learned that he got all of his degrees working by himself in his room, not going to university, going to university. And so he came to Paris when he felt the need of getting experience. You know?
I see.
So he came to Paris, and then he was my student for a year or so. And then we filed an application for him for a grant.
When was this now?
It was probably 1950. And so that grant eventually went through, and he got it. But when he got it, the CNRS could not get a hand on him because he was changing hotel from every 3 months or so. He got sick of that hotel, he went to a new one. So it was impossible to trace him. So then, as I was filing the application for him, and I was supposed to watch him, but as a supervisor or whatever it is, CNRS wrote to me, can you get a hand on Lowe? And so I got a hand on him by filing him through the police. I asked the police to get a hand on him.
I see.
And I wasn't living in hotels. They got him very easy, very soon. Because at that time, the police was keeping control on the hotels. They don't anymore. But only 1 year ago, I stopped. And so I got Laurent coming to my office. And he told me, well, you know, I never thought I would get a grant to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, you got it, and now you come. So he started working with us. And he started working on that thing, and he went to the Eclipse. And then Denis discovered that he was much better than what we were asking him for, and he asked him to study the synchrotron effect.
The synchrotron effect?
The synchrotron process. And Laurent wrote the basic paper on the synchrotron effect. And which is published in Annales of Physics, and which is still referred to.
Right, that's 57 or something like that. Yeah.
And he got his PhD on this. But unfortunately, he left after that, and he has never published anything since. How about so?
It seems like this 55 paper on 33 centimeter observations in the galactic plane was the first time that you did something not of the Sun.
Yeah. We used the red smoke in us in a...
What made you decide to switch from the Sun?
Because there were lots of things going on cosmic sources, and we got ready to observe them. I mean, I think that Denis was the guy who first thought that we were already sensitive enough to get cosmic sources. So he induced us to go through.
I see.
In this way.
So you had an increased capability.
Yes, the capability was up to looking at cosmic sources.
Right.
Before it wasn't. You know, even with the Earth's work at meter waves, I mean, you can hardly get into it.
Right. Except the three strongest sources.
Yeah, I said the two strongest sources.
Well, now moving on to later at Nansei, there were three main interferometers by the time that the Paris Symposium was held.
Yeah.
And these were all east-west arrays.
Yes.
At that time, operating at different wavelengths.
3 centimeters, 169, and 900 megs, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. The 3 centimeters array. You are talking about the two elements array. I couldn't do myself alone and people like me.
Well, I'm not sure. I just wrote down that there were three interferometers at Nansei. This is in your paper. I'm not sure if that includes Kunduz or
not. Well, now, in fact, I don't know. Because at 3 centimeters, we got two. There was a grating array.
Right.
Which I built with Monique Peak. Which was at the beginning 8 dishes and later on went to 16 dishes. Each of them was about a meter diameter. It's still operating, by the way. It's mounted on one of those American meter waves radar beams.
I see.
Supposed to come this way. And this is, they are still there. I mean, the mount is still there. It's still used to turn, rotate all these dishes.
I see.
It's a Meridian instrument. It's painted yellow and still operating. Like that. And it works. You get 1.5 minutes of rock, something like that. So it's very good to localize and measure the size and intensity of bright sources in the center of trees and areas. They are very much very useful for forecasting from. And we had also the Kundu interferometer, which is something I proposed to them. And Alan came in and went 1 or 2 years later because he had other ambitions. Well, he's now the boss of the import export from the US. And Kundu was a student of French government.
Right. I have talked with him.
Oh, so, did you?
Yes.
Well, he's going to be in here in 3 weeks.
Is he?
For 2 weeks. He's in Bonn, by the way. Yeah. And so Kundu and Alan and myself designed and built that thing. But we had no idea of really doing something to this work with this. But we wanted to know what the size of this burst were. And we did measure the size of this burst. And Kundu got his French PhD this way.
Right.
By carrying lots of measurements and correlating it with optical observations and meter-wise observations.
But this was still all east-west baseline.
Oh, yes.
Right? Well, when was the first north-south baseline put in?
Well, I don't know, you should ask Bloom. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's meter waves, you know. Bloom was meter wave man at that time.
Okay.
So he designed and built the north-south one, and including the phase-changing system to move the beam.
Right, that was in the 60s sometime.
It was all in the 60s, yes, I guess, with Mrs. Lescarin and some other people.
Now, also, there's a paper with you and Kundu in 59 in which you talk about the 60% of the bursts at 3 centimeters are polarized.
Yes, because
this is the first polarimetry that you've done, I guess.
Yes, but it was very easy because it was based on the idea that which was more or less Cambridge's, that if you turn one of the horns or the polarized field, you get polarized,
right.
You get the polarization. So we did it,
right.
So that's it. But you know, all of this was very new because you put everything in the air, anything in the air, and here you are. Nobody had ever done a polarization measurements on bursts, making sure that they were looking for the bursts themselves and not the background.
At these high frequencies.
And
yeah.
It has frequencies. So, you know, at that time it was much easier than now. I mean, you got an idea, and assuming that you were persistent enough to carry it through, you got results.
Right. Yeah.
So it was very simple.
When did it change? When did
it didn't change. Well, you know, we got the stereoscopic idea more recently, much more recently than this. To my opinion, it's somewhat a breakthrough too. But, it just comes like this.
Well, what I meant though is that you say then it was easy that you could get any new data was of interest,
yeah.
And you're,
well, it's,
you're
it's
implying that it's not that way now.
No, it's certainly not that way, but sometimes it's that way. It's a matter of chance.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about this stereoscopic idea because I think this is what we have, what we had in recent times, which is similar at that era. You know. But on radio astronomy itself, on
the
ground,
mean that you can do anything with the stereoscopic idea, and it's new, essentially.
Yeah, well, we suggested in the early 1970s that by using a remote space probe and ground-based observations, you can do stereoscopy on bursts.
Right.
Well, that was an idea which belongs more or less to the same kind of ideas, which is a new idea of doing something new, and you can get results out of it. So
right.
It was typical of the radio astronomy of the 50s.
Yeah,
you would get an idea like the Kundutron. We used to call the Kundutron. You use two dishes, you track. And the idea was that it was already done to do this. I mean, it was not new. But the idea was that we were used to tracking dishes. And we would look for the size of the burst. You know, it was nothing intensive. But it had not been done before.
Right.
So you put up an idea like this, you are persistent enough to carry it through and make it work, and you get results, and you publish papers.
Yeah.
But now it's more or less finished, except the very few cases in normal radio astronomy. And I think it was over in the 60s.
Mm.
And now it's complete.
About when my kind of person came into the field, we began to really get large.
Yeah, we are, you know.
The mid-60s.
The mid-60s. And also in the mid-60s, you get so many more teams, you know, that the ideas are going all over the place. You get much more communications.
Right.
That's normal. Nothing to do with it. It's just normal evolution of things.
Well, I think that covers. Or is there anything else up until the early 60s that you think should be mentioned?
Yes, there is something which is important, which is that in 1955. Professor Walker, who was still the head of the physics laboratory at the Panama Superior, he decided that he had started the radio astronomy in the 1940s, and he had supported it and kept it for 10 years, and it was enough. And his argument was that this laboratory, being more or less a physics laboratory attached to a higher school of some kind, you know, I mean, the equivalent of a university, he should not stick to a given field for too much. And so, and this was the first attitude, which was perfectly understandable. And the second attitude was that that thing was getting bigger and bigger and more expensive, and that it should be connected to regular observatory. And he had lots of other reasons also, which I don't want to enter into details. And so that the fact is that he entered into negotiations with Danjon, who was the boss and the head of the Paris Observatory. And then we had to move away from the École Normale Supérieure to the Paris Observatory. In fact, to Menon.
And when did that happen?
In 1956. But it was not done in one shot. I mean, Blum, Denis, you know, Denis was also looking for a position, you know, and also Blum, because Blum was more or less at that time an engineer, more or less on contract to the Navy, you know, and he didn't like this too much. And so that he was looking for a more or less permanent position. Mm-hmm. So the Paris Observatory had some. And so they went first. And I went later, for reasons which are more or less personal. You know, I had a fight with Rothbard, and so that it was more or less a so-called political balance. But it has nothing to do with that star anyway. And second, we were deeply engaged in the building of Marseille. It was very difficult for us, I mean, to move before some steps at least were achieved.
Right.
Before, for instance, the East-West Interferometer was in operation completely. Before the East-West Interferometer, 900 megacycles were completed.
Right.
And so I argued about this, and finally this is more or less the way it went. And so I moved to the Paris Observatory myself in 1956. And maybe Denis and Blum went maybe 1 year earlier,
right.
Tell you something like this. And they had to fight their way in here, which was not that easy. Because, you know,
they were radio people, you mean?
Well, not only because they were radio people. They were radio people, and they had very heavy needs as far as workshops and money and management were concerned.
Right.
They were used to do things on a more or less industrial way. And in here, the prototype was Lyot. And Lyot was a great man, but he worked already like what we call a bricoleur,
yeah.
A gash kind of man. And it is not right diminishing his merit, you know, by saying that.
Well,
the fact is
that
he left nearly no students after him except Lotus.
Mm-hmm.
And he made big breakthroughs, you know, the chronometer and the Lyot filter and all this. But in fact, they were not really never any used in here. They were not really used. And so there was no structure of any kind in this observatory. It was more or less an observing site, you know, there were Desanguja and Lyot. Lyot was dead, but his attitude of mind was still there. And the workshop was 3 people, you know, and there was no management organization, no...
Just old-time astronomy,
yeah.
More or less.
Okay, nothing to criticize, but the fact is that when those young people came in with a lot of money, they were jealous, you know, and so they were not really accepted very easily.
Mm.
And I am afraid they are not still, they are still not really accepted.
Mm.
Except that there are other groups which are using about the same methods.
Yeah, so you had a very different style. And
very different style of work. And so they were not really very accepted, and they were no more accepted when I came in.
Yeah.
And we are still different. Radio astronomy in here is a big department, you know, 100 people in one department. And there are lots of people still who say, let's say, these people are very agitating everything, they are running things, they are stirring things, and intuitively people don't like things to be stirred.
So when you moved to Meudon, would you say that it would sound like that it did not really help you with your collaboration with optical astronomy at all?
No.
It was just a change.
It didn't help with any bridging, you know.
Right, scientifically. Yeah. Which
a foreign body, I would say.
Yeah.
A foreign body in your body. It's just a foreign.
Yeah.
It's strange. But, you know, they succeeded in getting lots of results. I mean, we succeeded in getting results, and we became known, I mean, in lots of other places, and finally, radio astronomy fought its way. But in fact, everybody who is interested in radio astronomy now are young people. The older ones still kept away.
Yeah.
And you get a number of so-called classical optical astronomers who understand that they cannot keep away from radio astronomy and who know a lot of it and who are working in between. You know, Heidmann, for instance, went among the first, and Véron were among the first to look at the stars optically, and who are radio astronomers by training. You know, so that things eased, but it has been very.
That's interesting. I don't think there is any French optical astronomer who got involved in radio astronomy results or anything like that.
Yeah, there is one,
until the 50s.
Vlerick, for instance. Vlerick, Vlerick. He is a man who has been trained by Lallemand. He has been active at Boulder on coronometer development, by the way.
I see.
With Nuclear. And when he came back, he was specializing in very weak objects. And that guy moved to quasars.
I see, but that was in the 60s, though.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In the late 60s.
So there's nothing in the 50s.
And Véron did the opposite way. He came in radio astronomy, and then he went to observe.
Right. Once again, that was quasars and radio
astronomy. But all these people were very young.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
I mean, Eric is my age, but he's in his 50s. But Véron is in his early 40s.
Yeah.
But it has taken a little time. And the same for space. Space research, just the same. Radio astronomy is still more or less tolerated in here. I would not say
tolerated.
It's tolerated. It's accepted, but that's all.
Yeah.
And space research is hardly tolerated. Because you know, it passes a. We spend about half of the total budget of the observatory in this department. Because as you know, space research is very expensive.
Right.
So you know, people think that we are very wealthy, which is stupid, because we are not on a day-to-day basis, we are not more wealthy than any others, except that the things we build are very expensive. So, but
your office is no bigger.
No. But I keep the whole office the same size.
Right.
Whether you are the actor or not, you don't really need bigger space.
Is there anything else before the early 60s that we haven't covered?
No, but that shift, I mean, from the economic sphere to this place where the big change.
Right.
Now the NASA station developed.
What about the Paris Symposium in 1958?
It was a big bubble. That's all I can tell you.
Well, as a local organizer, you mean? Yeah.
I think I have never been so tired. It's terrible. And now this year, they are in a general assembly, but I decided I would keep away.
Yeah. But do you see that meeting as
It was very important because it was very important because first lots of people acknowledged the fact that we were just in the move. I mean, you know, we were included in the general movement for astronomy in the world because they decided to hold that symposium in Paris. It did not mean that they recognized we were the first, by no means. We never thought that was the way. But it was a more or less international recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And it was useful, especially for the other astronomers and for the people who have the money. It was useful. Also, it was very useful as a symposium. It was a very useful symposium. It was the last one who was devoted to radio astronomy as a branch of science.
Right.
Later on, it was no longer like this, and it was okay. It was right not to hold anymore like this.
Right.
But it was the symposium where it was recognized that radio astronomy was a part of the rest of astronomy, and we could not anymore keep separate. And even the radio astronomy department here, they work in connection with lots of other people outside the department. And the main reason is that their technology.
Hmm.
And so but there are no other reasons besides maybe historical reasons, personal feelings.
Right.
But that's all. Véron, for instance, is no longer working even with the Department of Radio Astronomy. He's still doing radio astronomy, but somewhere else. He has an office outside. It doesn't. But it was really the symposium where it was realized that radio astronomy had to work with the rest of the
world. Yeah, I have that feeling too.
And accepted by. And there were lots of astronomers there, I mean, the so-called classical.
Yeah,
when I say classical, it's not context. I mean, it's just that they were not ready.
Right.
And so that, I think it was very important symposium. But I remember it as a terrible experience.
You have a different view.
No, I have that view too, because I attended it, but it was very hard for me.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
That ends the interview with Steinberg on 8th July, 76.